This is Dr. Richard Perrone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Andrew DeBona. Today is September 11th, 2003. It's about 9:10 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. DeBona, you are in Ennis, Montana. Let's start, sir, with a biographical sketch of yourself. Could you tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about growing up?
I was born in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, on the 3rd of October, 1936. Mm-hmm. That was where the hospital was, and where I actually grew up was Ebensburg, Pennsylvania, which was about 17 miles away. I was an only child. My father was came over from Italy. My mother was a descendant of German and Irish parents, mm-hmm. both of whom came over from the old country. Mm-hmm. So I am a first-generation Italian.
Okay.
I led a normal life in Ebensburg in that I went to Catholic school for 8 years and then high school for 4 years.
Okay. What are your earliest memories of Ebensburg? What about your family life at home? You were the only child. What was it like growing up there?
It was a very nice town there. Nothing ever happened in Ebensburg.
Okay.
My earliest memories, I think, of course, of living the places where I lived at the time. One place we lived was near the railroad tracks. My father and mother were divorced when I was in the seventh grade, so I didn't see much of my father after that. He would periodically come by, but not too much. We'd go out hunting and fishing, which I enjoyed quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a rural-type community, like I said, a population of about 4,700 people.
Okay.
The county seat of the county, and the primary industry, if you wish, was coal. There were a lot of mines around
mm-hmm.
the area.
Mm-hmm. Where is this in relation to, say, Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh, we're approximately 55 miles to the southeast.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
My mother was a housewife, but after the father left, and she was working as a waitress.
Okay.
My father initially started out in driving a bread truck, and he got into insurance sales and eventually into automobile sales.
Okay. Did your mother end up remarrying?
No. Oh, correction, yes. Way after the fact, when I was probably in my 30s.
Okay.
She married an individual.
Okay. What kind of jobs did you have in your youth? Did you work?
Yes, I caddied at the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at my grandfather's mine to get bulked up for football, which was not a very smart decision.
Tell me about that. What did you do?
Well, I was. We had a little mule down there, and he had about a one-horse, and that's exactly what it was, a one-horse mine. So I'd go in there and dig out the coal
mm-hmm.
and load it in the car, and the mule would go out and dump the coal and come back in again.
Okay.
And the other thing I did, I worked for 35 cents an hour after that at my father's, at his garage, where I would do any number of things, including wash the cars, clean them up on the inside, change tires,
mm-hmm.
General, nothing skilled type,
mm-hmm.
just general maintenance type things.
Okay. And how about into high school? Did you continue working?
No, that was when I was in high school.
Oh, that was? Okay.
My junior and senior year.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Tell me about going to school, starting in your youth. What did you enjoy as subjects, and how were you as a student?
Initially in grade school, but the Catholic school, I enjoyed just about everything. GCT or IQ testing, I was the highest in the class.
Mm-hmm.
I got all A's and B's. When I got into high school, I was diagnosed with having rheumatic fever on my freshman year. I went to school at 5'8", 135. When I came back to school 3 months later, I was 6 foot, 175. And also, I didn't get any in-home teaching or tutoring, so consequently, I got, and deservedly so, the attitude or the reputation of a bad student.
Okay.
So in high school then, what I'd primarily do, I'd slide by. I lettered in my sophomore, junior, and senior years in both football and basketball. state championship of the state of Pennsylvania.
Hmm. Okay. What positions did you play in basketball and football?
Basketball, I was the center, and football, I was the right end.
Okay.
And that was when we went both ways.
Right, right. Was it expected for you to go to college? Did your parents emphasize education and post-secondary education?
College wasn't mentioned per se. However, I did get a football scholarship out. But due to my low grades, I think I graduated 117th out of 121.
Mm-hmm.
The only saving grace to it, my SAT scores came out extremely high. And so I was offered a football scholarship to Massanutten mm-hmm. Military Academy, sort of a prep school,
mm-hmm.
and also a college scholarship to Washington and Lee.
Okay. And which one, did you pick one of the two?
I went to the prep school, however, at the same time that happened, the gal that I'd been going with, my high school study,
mm-hmm.
Turned out pregnant.
Okay.
So I dropped out of school and joined the Marine Corps.
Okay. What year was this?
This was 1955.
Okay. How long had you attended the prep school?
I had been in the prep school. We went down there in August, and I till December.
Okay.
My grades at that point were, once again, A's and B's.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about military experience in your family. Had your dad or anyone else served in the military previous to you?
My father was drafted in 1944 for a period of about, he was at the time almost 40 years old. He spent, I believe, a little bit less than 2 months until he was discharged.
Okay. Is there anyone else?
No, on my grandmother's side, on my mother's side, rather, no one actually, they weren't in the military.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Later, a cousin of mine joined the Army, but he was in for 2 years.
Okay. Do you have any memories of World War II?
The only memory I have of World War II is the end of World War II,
uh-huh.
when they used to have the sirens in town to signify the air attacks in case the Japanese came over, and also the drills that we had in school where everyone would get under the desks waiting for the Japanese planes or the German planes to drop their bombs
mm-hmm.
On Ebbersburg, Pennsylvania, obviously. And I'm sure that was a federally mandated type thing.
Right.
And the end of the war, I remember the town was closed down simply because all the sirens were going off and people were dancing in the streets.
Hmm.
And that was my recollections of World War II.
Okay. How about Korea?
Korea, not very many at all, even though I was almost in high school. Then I believe I was probably in the eighth or ninth grade. My only memory of Korea, per se, is that one of the seniors who had joined the Navy
mm-hmm.
Was a corpsman with the Marines, and he was KIA'd.
Hmm.
But that is about the only memory of Korea, per se.
Mm-hmm. Tell me why you joined the Marine Corps. First of all, why the military, and then specifically, why the Marine Corps?
Why the military? The draft was still in vogue at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I figured that since I was not going to school, I did not have an education or a trade, so I figured I would be able to kill two birds with one stone because I eventually wanted to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I was married with a child and the whole thing. But
mm-hmm.
I figured I'd need something to support the family.
Mm-hmm.
And why the Marine Corps? I went down to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which was the nearest recruiting office, to specifically join the Air Force. The Air Force recruiter was not in next door. The only recruiter who, in fact, was in was the Marine Corps recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
And I stuck my head in his door and said something to the effect, when will the Air Force recruiter be back? And he said, boy, what a deal I have for you. And that's the short story long.
Right. Okay. And so he persuaded you that the Corps was the elite, I take it, and that it would be a good fit for you.
Yeah. Well, it was more or less a challenge. I don't think you could make it as a Marine Corps boy.
Okay. Okay. So you got married, and you had a child, and now you're going to go off to basic training.
No, the marriage part, yes, between the time that I initially saw the recruiter, and at that time you weren't allowed to be married and join the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So between the time I initially reported in, got my physical and everything, and then I had my ship date, which was the 17th of January, we got married on the 10th of January.
Okay. All right. Where did you do your basic?
At Parris Island, South Carolina.
Okay. So tell me about your basic training. What were your general impressions when you first stepped off the bus down there on the island?
In retrospect, at the time, it was probably nothing but except shock.
Mm-hmm.
And how could people do this? How could people yell at you at this type of thing? Because I came from a, if you will, somewhat of a peaceful environment, and then being thrown into the Marine Corps environment. And since that, of course, since that time, I've been in that recruit training type environment. But it, the initial thing was, like I said, just plain shock.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I had to get through it, and I knew I had to prove myself.
Okay. Tell me about basic. What was it like?
Basic was difficult. I had never had that sort of discipline before.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the drill instructors picked me out to be one of the, in fact, the section leader for the platoon. So I was one of three people who married meritorious PFC.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, that meant an extra $5 a month, which was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the experience. It was a military type of thing. And in fact, I did a study later for my master's degree on the performance of a male from a father's child.
Mm-hmm.
Male from father's family on recruit training, because there was always a knock about that that type of an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that in my thesis that that had little, if any, bearing on it. The main thing was the person had the 12th grade education.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, did he have the stick to itiveness to go ahead and going through high school? And that was a better indicator of his performance in recruit training than any of the other variables that they were referring to.
Mm-hmm. How did you adopt to the military lifestyle? Was it difficult for you?
No, not really. I considered myself a type A personality anyhow, and I was always physical. And the physical aspect, the mental aspect was not really that much. I thought I was intelligent enough to see through what was eventually happening by the time the fourth or fifth week came along.
Mm-hmm.
It was enjoyable, if you will.
Hmm. Okay. What would you say was the most difficult part of it for you?
Boy, probably the most difficult part was initially being in charge of. I was the drill instructor's right-hand man.
Mm-hmm.
They would tell me what to do, and then I'd have the whole platoon do it. And sometimes some people in the platoon would not concede that I was acting in the drill instructor's behalf, so I would have to counsel them. And that was probably the hardest part of it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Physical was no problem. Mental was no problem. And at that time, probably the first time that I'd ever been actually away from Ebensburg, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably being away from home also had something in there somewhere. But I sort of put that in the back of my mind.
Did you feel like you were a natural leader, or did your leadership kind of surprise you once you had been selected and you were able to carry out those duties?
My concept of myself was that I was smarter than the average bear. By virtue of going to the military academy there at Massanutten for that period of time,
mm-hmm.
I had, in fact, had some discipline. I knew a little bit more than the average person coming in there, excuse me, concerning drill, weapons. I'd hunted all my life, so I was good with weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if leadership by example could be proven, of course, I didn't know all those words at that time or the principles of leadership or anything else, but I felt that I was in my element, yes.
Okay. How much did it help you that you had handled weapons before? Was that a clear advantage for you?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Because some of the Marines coming out of the cities, for instance, but had never had a rifle before in their hand,
mm-hmm.
by virtue of the fact that I had known how to field strip the M1 rifle, which I had to do in the military academy. So I was able to do that and also teach that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What kind of weapons training did you receive at Parris Island?
At Parris Island, we FAM-fired the .45, which is just a familiar ASIN fire, and then we shot 2 weeks at the rifle range. First week consisted of snapping in where you'd get into the positions that the Marine Corps would deem appropriate for firing the weapon mm-hmm. at a known distance target, not combat training. And then the second week was actually getting to your dope on your rifle, getting your zero on your weapon, and actual live firing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What would you say was a typical day at Parris Island?
Typical day at Parris Island. Boy. Depending upon if at the range we'd get up a little bit earlier, but a typical day was probably up at 0600 during the latter stages of recruit training. It was a just flip on the lights and you'd immediately get out of the rack.
Mm-hmm.
During the initial stages, before the lights would come on, the garbage cans were rolling down, the drill instructors would be in there screaming and hollering.
Mm-hmm.
So you would get out of the rack and stand in front of the rack facing inboard at the position of attention in your skivvies, and you were then given the word you have 15 minutes to shower, shave, and get ready.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd go to the chow hall for the morning meal, and you go through the chow hall, and after getting done eating, you would go outside and wait where the platoon was ordered to form.
Mm-hmm.
From that point in time, you'd go do a various and sundry things, whether it was class, whether it was the conference course, whether it was bayonet training, anything like that. But you would actually go to the classes then or go to the specific physical training.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, the same thing would happen in the noon meal. After you get done with that, you go back to the barracks. You'd have the 10 or 15 minutes to go ahead and get spruced up, so to speak, get out, stand in formation, then march on over. Initially, the DEIs did all the marching. Later on, I was able to go ahead and march the platoon over there.
Mm-hmm.
The afternoon was a sort of a mirror image of the morning, with the exception of different classes. The hardest thing I remember about that was not falling asleep.
Oh, really?
Yes. The drill instructors were very unyielding if a recruit started to nod off and fall asleep in the class. That was mm-hmm. not deemed military.
What would they do?
Well, they would normally come up behind the recruit and either give him a reassuring tap on the shoulder or have him stand in the back of the room if he started to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
The voluntary thing was, if you were starting to fall asleep, you would stand up in the back of the room and listen to the lecture. The involuntary thing was, once you got the wrap on the back of the shoulder, then you would get up and go into the back of the room.
Okay.
I never had that happen. I mean, I don't know why, but I didn't. I do know that I've nodded off any number of times and sort of came back to again.
Mm-hmm.
Evening then was spent getting ready for the next day, shining shoes, various and sundry things. We'd drill probably until about 2000 or 8 o'clock that evening, and drill was that's what everybody did.
Mm-hmm.
If in every waking moment, if you weren't in class, you weren't eating, you weren't doing something, you would be drill.
Mm-hmm.
And normally in the evening, then we'd also have about later, we'd have about 15 or 20 minutes of what was called free time, where you could go ahead and write. And then it would be in the racks at exactly 2200, 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the typical day.
Okay. Were your DIs Korean vets?
Yes, all three of them.
Did they talk about their experiences?
Rarely. They weren't there as an eye. And a strange thing about that, I ran into two of them later
mm-hmm.
in the Marine Corps. One was a gunnery sergeant by the name of Cochran, who just died, and the other one was a staff sergeant by the name of Stamey, who I ran into in when I was a captain in Johnstown, he was in Johnstown, Pennsylvania with the INI.
Mm-hmm.
He was at that time a gunnery sergeant and made corporal by wrecking a Marine Corps vehicle while he was on INI.
Mm.
But, yeah, they were all Korean vets and very competent and very able and just great Marines. At least that's who we emulated, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. How would you rate the training overall at Parris Island?
Redundant, particularly in the stage of drills, but I understand now, having been the commanding officer of a recruit training battalion later, that the redundancy, the idea behind that is to make sure that you are no longer an individual, you are a member of a team,
mm-hmm.
which the Marine Corps attempts to do. And it's been said many times that the Corps during recruit training, which is a mythical type of experience, breaks down the individual from who they were from a boy and graduates a Marine.
Did you find that to be true?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
Okay. How long did your Parris Island training go?
At that point in time, we were 12 weeks.
Okay.
And while there also, this is when we took our various tests to see where our recruit, what we would do after Parris Island. And I was, at the time, the Marine Corps had a certain intelligence quota or an IQ quota go to specific schools. I was selected to go to aviation school.
Okay.
However, what happened was that prior to graduation, had a couple of officers come around and ask me if I had ever played football. And of course, that was a well-known fact.
Mm-hmm.
And make a short story long there, instead of going to aviation school after recruit training and also the advanced infantry training at Camp Geiger, I was assigned to Parris Island to play football.
Really?
Yes.
Huh. On the Marine Corps football team?
Yes.
Okay. And how long did that last?
Well, there, in addition to playing football there, I was also working in the gas station,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of a, not necessarily an indicator, but it wasn't my idea of when I joined the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
But that lasted for a period of 3 years until I eventually went and said, I don't want to play football anymore. And this isn't why I joined the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
I had been promoted to corporal, been promoted to sergeant. I said I wanted to do something else besides that. So from there, I went over and started working in the brig.
Okay. What year was this?
This was in 1959.
Okay.
58.
In 58. Okay. What position did you play for the Marine Corps football team?
End.
Same thing.
Yes.
Okay. So in 58, you went to work at the brig. What were your duties?
I was the turnkey initially. Turnkey there, which is the due to my just coming into the thing, I was the assistant turnkey initially,
mm-hmm.
which two people on duty at the same time, making sure that the prisoners knew that they did not want to come back there again, basically to enforce discipline. Not corporally in any way, shape, or form would
mm-hmm.
we ever do that,
mm-hmm.
but continually up and down and harassment-type indicators. After that, then I got to be the turnkey where I supervise the other people, the other Marines working there with the prisoners.
Mm-hmm. How long did you do that?
I did that for a period of about 9 months.
Okay.
My thought at this time was, hey, this would give me good training as far as getting out of the Marine Corps and perhaps joining the police force.
Okay, so at this point you did not plan to make the Marine Corps a career?
That's correct.
Okay. What happened after at the brig? Where did you go?
After the brig, I was given, it's unusual that I had spent a little bit over, I had a four-year enlistment.
Mm-hmm.
I'd spent a little bit over, it's 3 years and 2 months at the at Parris Island, and I received orders to go report to Okinawa with the 3rd Marine Division.
Mm-hmm.
At that period in time, I had 2 children with another one on the way,
mm-hmm.
and so I extended my enlistment to be able to not only have my wife deliver the child
mm-hmm.
and have the medical benefits pay for it, but also to make sure that I had a stable income,
mm-hmm.
at least until I got back. So I extended the enlistment, and then I was assigned to a bulk fuel company, which, by virtue of working in the gas station,
mm-hmm.
that's what my MOS was.
Okay. And when did you ship off to Okinawa?
I left, that was July of 59.
Okay.
And I got back, once over there in Okinawa, I once again decided, instead of working in bulk fuel, which I didn't know, I played football over there too.
Huh. Okay. How long were you there?
It was a 2-year tour, but I only spent 20 months there since I shipped over for another 6 years at that time. My wife had gotten a job down at Parris Island. She was doing very well in the civil service field, and by the shipping over, monies allowed us to buy a mobile home or a trailer.
Okay. So you were able to come back and live in South Carolina?
Yes. In fact, that was one of the options when I shipped over. I was then stationed at the Marine Corps Air Station in Beaufort, South Carolina, where I was working in the mess hall as the storage guy. And while there at the air station, I also taught classes to other Marines, and I had taken at that point, I think, 19 or 20 Marine Corps Institute courses, because I figured if I'm going to stay in this outfit, I better start learning something about it.
Tell me about playing football in Okinawa. What was that like? Who did you play?
We played everybody there. At that point in time, the Marines had a team, the Army had a team. We were the Sukaran Raiders. We played the Army, the Air Force. Navy did not have a team, but there were about five teams there on Okinawa.
And was the season just in the fall, or was it year-round?
Just in the fall.
Okay. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, in the sense that it was something different, and it got me away from the bulk fuel company, where I was at that point in time assigned as the police sergeant, which is the scrounger or the individual who makes sure that something needs to get done, I would get it done.
Okay. When did you come back into Beaufort, South Carolina? Was it 61?
Got back there in 60.
Okay.
And I want to say it was around, I don't actually remember the definite dates.
That's okay. That's not a problem. How long were you in Beaufort?
When I was in Beaufort, I eventually started looking into a few things, including OCS, Officers Candidate School. Because I figured I didn't want to be an enlisted Marine my whole career. Not that there was anything wrong with that, but I felt I had more potential than that. So I was there probably for a period of about 9 to 10 months. And I applied for Officers Candidate School through the Meritorious NCO program.
Okay.
And the Marine Corps had a board that met and selected 25 Marines from throughout the Marine Corps to go to 25 enlisted Marines to go NCOs, to go through Officers Candidate School. And I received my orders on 10th of September, I believe it was, to report on the 15th of September.
Okay. And to where, Quantico?
Quantico, Virginia, that's correct.
Okay. So 1960 September. What was Quantico like?
Quantico was a sort of a modified recruit training in that the OCS, and the ironic thing is I went through Bravo Company in OCS, and in 1967, I commanded that company. But anyhow, it was a modified OCS. They spread two to three former enlisted around to each of the platoons to look more or less take care of the college boys that came in. Age-wise, I was about 2 years older.
How old were you?
At that time, I was 25.
Okay.
I had my 25th birthday there.
Okay.
And I was about 2 or 3 years older. Plus, I knew quite a bit about the Marine Corps, being in almost 7 years at that time as an enlisted service. So the drill instructors there, or they were called sergeant instructors, not drill instructors, they would pretty well turn over the platoon to the former enlisted. And I'd hold classes on how to pass the test, and I was assigned there to the jock platoon.
Surprise, surprise, right?
Yeah. In that, the jock platoon was the, all the former football players who was, were going through OCS at that time.
Okay.
So that was the platoon that I was assigned to.
How sharp were they?
Say again?
How sharp were they? Were they good Marines, or were, did you have to work really hard with them?
I would say, you know, that once the basics got established, they were extremely dedicated. We were called the Animal Platoon also, and that in competition with other platoons at time throughout the recruit or the OCS regiment, that we would always win on the three-mile run, on the PT test, on the obstacle course, tug of war. I mean, you name it, we take it.
Okay. How long did OCS last for you?
I graduated on the 16th as a second lieutenant on the 16th of December 1961. On the 15th of December, my warrant came in for sergeant, which they have never presented.
Okay.
As I was a sergeant E4 at the time, and that's when the Marine Corps had undergone their rank change, where they added the lance corporal to their ranks prior to that.
Okay. Before we leave Quantico, was there anything that stands out in your mind when you think back about that training?
Not really. It was, like I say, it was a sort of a redundancy of recruit training, except a lot easier. It was probably, in my estimation, probably about 80%. Yeah, one slight difference. It was probably about 80% physical and 20% mental. While recruit training, it seemed to me, was around 60% physical and 40% mental.
Okay.
And that was the differentiation I would draw between the two types of training. Of course, you're talking training a different individual, too, but to get the same product, a Marine.
Right. How were the college boys, as you said?
The college boys were really good people. I mean, I had no problem with them whatsoever.
Okay.
They were very eager to learn. They obviously had volunteered for the Marine Corps, and some of them had quite a long history of their parents being in the Marine Corps and so on and so forth.
Okay.
They were dedicated, and even though it was the jock platoon, and that they weren't as academically as sharp as some of the other platoons there, but we got by.
Okay. Okay. Except for Quantico, where did you go?
Stayed at Quantico because after the OCS, there was a thing called the basic school. And I was the second lieutenant, obviously, at that time. Now, the basic school, to me, is a completely different experience because I figured once I got commissioned, I'm a second lieutenant. However, up there, I became a student officer, and I didn't like that.
Why not?
In that, instead of being treated like an officer, I felt I was being treated like a college kid. And by that, I mean that the... talked down to continually. There were captains there who were the platoon commanders at the time. And the one that we had was a tanker, and I knew nothing about tankers at that time. But the people assigned there, I felt, and also our officers at OCS were not the, the highest quality people that the Marine Corps had. They were more or less marking time there. Some of the instructors were extremely good. Some of them were extremely bad.
What would you do in basic school? How long did it last?
Basic,
and then
the basic school lasted a period of about, let's see, December, January, about 4 months. Well, it could have been longer, 4 to 5 months. But it was basically Marine Corps history, as I said before, the academics more than the physical and mental. There's primary academics there, map reading, tactics, the basic infantry officer type of things.
How did you do academically?
Academically, I was probably in the top quarter, but I never really applied myself.
Why was that?
I felt that I knew most of the stuff. There were some things that I didn't know that I would devote more of my time to. To, if you will, look at my professional development.
Okay. So this is 1962. Did you have any information or any inkling about U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia at this point?
No.
Okay.
The big thing was their the last war, which was Korea.
Right.
And the better instructors who were there as captains had been in Korea.
Mm-hmm. Did they talk about their experiences with you?
Some, not all, and their experiences were what they would talk about it, not necessarily leading troops, but terrain, weather, mm-hmm. things of that nature.
Right, right. Okay. So after basic school, when you completed that, did you stay in Quantico or did you leave?
No, at that time I was assigned to the 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines down at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
Okay.
Went down there and I was reported into a battalion where I was assigned as the 106 Recoilless Rifle Platoon Commander.
Okay.
And that unit was getting ready to go on a med float in about 6 months. So what happened with the 106 Recoilless Rifle Platoon, once I got there within the first couple of months, we had a very tight unit, and what would happen is that any of the line companies or H&S company that were having a problem with the Marine, he was assigned to the 106 Recoilless Rifle and Flames. Also, Flamethrower was, mm-hmm. I had that with me.
Mm-hmm. Why were they assigned to your platoon?
In that my brand of discipline, perhaps, my brand of being a Marine, that I was probably a tad bit stronger than most. In fact, my fitness report at that time, the first one that I got in the Marine Corps, I was rated number one out of 64 lieutenants.
Hmm. Can you describe what your brand was of a Marine?
I would treat them like Marines. If they screwed up, they got treated like Marines. We'd be out for a run, for example, and everybody would be getting tired, including me. But so then they'd start bickering back there, so we'd stop a platoon. I would have them go get the boxing gloves, actually pillows.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, if you two have a little something to take out, if you have that much energy left, you may start doing that. Instead of going for office hours for a minor offense, I would have them go out and dig a 6x6x6 hole,
mm-hmm.
and fill it back in. Just the general way, I guess, my demeanor, that I was no-nonsense. I had a reputation of being no-nonsense but fair.
Okay. And how long did you do this with the 106?
106, I had them for about 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was assigned to a platoon in Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines.
Okay. And what did you do with Kilo?
In Kilo, I was a rifle platoon commander, which I always wanted to be, instead of the 106s, which were a supporting weapon. And general platoon commander duties.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of my best things there, I had a sergeant of mine who was an extremely sharp individual, and I put him for the OCS program. He retired as a major general in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
Another guy, my platoon guide, later I wrote a recommendation for him, and he retired as a major.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just more hands-on with the people, and that I knew everyone and everyone, what their kids' names, what mm-hmm. their problems were, and mm-hmm. everything of that.
Okay. What was your rank at this time?
At that time, I had just... 1 year, 1 year in grade, I was then a first lieutenant.
Okay. And how long did you stay with Kilo Company?
I was transferred down to Marine Corps Barracks, Yorktown, Virginia, or Marine Corps Weapons Station,
mm-hmm.
Marine Corps Barracks, Yorktown, Virginia. I got down there in 64.
Mm-hmm.
And the month, I don't quite remember. It was
okay.
probably, though, during the summer, because the children were getting out of school and that nature.
Okay. Okay. And what were your duties at Yorktown?
Initially, I was the platoon commander for the... we had two platoons over at the special weapons facility.
Mm-hmm.
And special weapons I will not go into, but it's where they made things that go with have mushrooms.
Okay.
And when they go bang, and I was there for a period of 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the individual sitting next to me, a guy by the name of Mike Downs, later retired as a two-star general.
Okay.
And from there, I was promoted to captain, and for the last 6 months, I was then transferred to main side, or the other guard detachment there,
mm-hmm.
where I was the commander of the guard, or the company commander of the guard platoon main side.
Okay. And so you're there from 64 until?
66.
Okay, and is that where you received your orders to go to Southeast Asia?
That's correct.
Okay. Tell me what you knew of 64, 65, and into 1966 about what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia.
I had, during this period of time, taken a number of courses,
mm-hmm.
Correspondence courses through special forces.
Mm-hmm.
My idea and my knowledge at that time, it was a guerrilla war, so consequently I took everything I could from, in fact, I think they had three non-resident special forces courses that I took,
mm-hmm.
And I'd read anything I could about guerrilla tactics, particularly tactics concerning the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as knowing the overall goals, overall aims, or the big picture, nothing. I was concentrating more or less on how I could be an effective commander there, leading
okay.
Marines.
So did you know that you were going or suspect that you were definitely going to end up there?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
okay.
that was because when the Marines submit their fitness report,
mm-hmm.
Which is their semi-annually thing, you always request where you want, or you request your dream list, and I kept requesting Vietnam.
Okay. Why did you do that?
Well, first of all, I felt that I was a professional Marine.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been 11 years in the Marine Corps almost by that time. I had never been shot at, and I feel that my professionalism would not be really tested, or I wouldn't know how good I was or how bad I was until such time as I had the opportunity to be in the combat.
Okay. Tell me why, I take it this was on your own, but tell me why you were studying guerrilla war so closely. Was this recommended by other Marines, or was
No.
this something that you had an insight into yourself?
Yes. It was not recommended. I mean, I decided that since that was the only war we had at the time, that I'd better be as good as or the best I could be.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to get everything I could and read on the topic.
Okay. Do you find that once you got to Vietnam, did that help you any?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Okay. We'll come to that when we get to that
sure.
point in Vietnam. We can talk about how that helped you. So tell me about your family feelings about you getting orders to Vietnam. How do they feel about this?
It was a sort of a foregone conclusion because all Marines, the general, everybody was going to go to Vietnam
mm-hmm.
who was in the Marine Corps but had time to do it,
mm-hmm.
particularly officer, so the main thing was, you know, that I was going to be in a safe environment. In fact, during my first tour, my mother thought I was a courier away from the front lines going back and forth until my name made the papers, and that sort of blew that one.
Mm-hmm.
But mother was extremely anxious, and as children and wife,
right,
who were living then at that time aboard the base at Camp Pendleton.
Okay. Okay. When did you get your orders to Vietnam?
I got orders to Vietnam, it was probably April of 66.
Okay.
And I was ordered to report down to a newly forming battalion, which was the 3rd Battalion, 26th Marines, down at Camp Pulgas.
Mm-hmm.
The wife came out later, after the children got out of school. So to make sure that I got a company, I reported in a week early.
Okay.
And I was the third officer who reported in. The XO was there,
mm-hmm.
CO was there, and I was the third officer,
mm-hmm.
thinking that since I got in early, I would get a rifle company. However, once they took a look at my background, I was assigned the battalion S4,
mm-hmm.
which is logistics and...
Mm-hmm.
Mechanics, beans, bolts, and band-aids, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you feel about that?
I was pissed.
Yeah? And this was going to be your duty in Vietnam?
Well, this is my thought. I, And I figured that, God, you know, I didn't join the Marine Corps to go count bullets or count Band-Aids or to arrange transportation or to get ammo. I joined the Marine Corps to, you know, go get shot at, quite frankly,
right
at that point in time. So my expectations were not fulfilled, shall we say.
Okay, okay. Did you go over with the 3rd Battalion?
We went over as an advance party, myself, the S3, and the communication officer. We, while the battalion sailed over on ships, we flew over and landed in country on the 27th of August with 1st Battalion, 26 Marines, who was at that point in time the Special Landing Force. And we joined them and observed them and how they operated and so on and so forth, because one of the things that 326, 3rd Battalion, 26 Marines, were going to do when they got there, they were going to take over duties as the Special Landing Force.
Okay.
And they had landed as Special Landing Force at that point in time, whose mission was a sort of an offshore reserve. If a big contact is made, boom, the SLF is in there. So we stayed there with them until I think it was around early September, at which point in time 326, which had sailed from Carlton or San Diego, they landed in Okinawa, where they offloaded the Navy shipping they came over on to onload other Navy shipping, which was also an S4 priority.
Where initially, in August 66, where initially did you land? In
We landed close to the DMZ, a little bit to the north-north east of Dong Ha.
Okay.
And it was called, I believe the operation was called Deckhouse 1, or it might have been Deckhouse 2. It was some Deckhouse operation.
Okay. What were your first impressions of Vietnam?
When I landed that time?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Scared.
Really?
Well, yeah, my impression of what in the hell's going on here, you know. I mean, you see and you read and you have preconceived ideas and you know what you're going to do, or you think you know what you're going to do. But we were on the LPH, for instance, when they brought in the medevacs. And to see the Marines coming off there, you know, with portions of...
What kind of expectations did you have that were shattered?
I felt that it would be a much more controlled environment, so to speak. In other words, we'd go find the bad guys, we'd bring in the world in on them, and that would be it.
Instead, what happened?
Instead, sometimes when we'd find the bad guys, the world would not come in on them, and we'd leave.
Okay. And what were your duties there? Were you just observing, or were you actually able to go out into the field and engage, or what?
There was no engagement per se. I went out on a couple of medevacs as far as that goes, but as far as actually seeing what a bad guy looked like, I never saw what one looked like.
Okay.
As far as actually having someone shoot at me personally, no, that didn't happen. It was just an observer-type role of how things happened. Or what is the reality, if you will, of Vietnam as opposed to what are your preconceived ideas? And that stood me in good stead, I believe.
Okay. Okay. When did you meet up with the 3rd of the 26th?
We met up with them in early September then.
Okay.
When we once again formed the SLF, we went on a riverine operation because the concept was, at that time, we might get one of the contingency plans was that we would go into Four Corps or down the Delta Rungsat zone. So we would have to be riverine capable, and what were the things of that. And we trained there. We never did make a landing until the 16th of December of 66 when the battalion came ashore.
Okay. All right. Tell me a little bit about your impressions of the morale of the American troops when you first arrived in Vietnam and what you first observed.
The ones, when I first arrived, you know, the ones that I didn't really pay that much attention to the troops at that time because my job, and when we're talking August now.
Yes, sir.
We're not talking December. We're
That's
talking
right.
August. When my main thrust at that time was, well, how do we get medevacs out? How do we get the beans and bullets out? What are the problems as far as mining of the roads, things of that nature?
Mm-hmm.
I was not troop-oriented, if you will, because that wasn't my forte then.
Mm-hmm.
My forte was the logistical type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do I get request new batteries? Where do they come from? How much lead time there is in this? What parts do we need? And that was the primary function. Then it was a mechanical versus a humanistic type thing.
Mm-hmm. How did you find the logistical system?
Workable. However, there was always the back door. And I hearken back to my days as the supply sergeant or the police sergeant for, you know, the last time I was in Okinawa.
Yes, sir.
And there's always a way to get something if you have something to trade for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is not the concept the Marine Corps would like you to do, but however, it is the accomplishment of the mission.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about December 66. Where did the 3rd of the 26th make the landing?
They initially went into Dong Ha.
Okay.
It was an administrative type landing.
Mm-hmm.
In that there was no combat, no assaulting the beach, nothing of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Correction, it was the 12th. I'm looking at my book here because I have my book here with the dates. It was the 12th of December.
Okay.
When they landed. And just going in, setting up a palace guard around the perimeter of Dong Ha, running a few patrols, waiting for a mission, which the mission was eventually assigned.
Okay. And you were still serving in the S-4 position?
That's correct.
Okay. And was there any chance of you getting a company at this point?
I was beginning to wonder that.
Okay. And did you still want that?
Oh, without a doubt.
Okay. Okay.
And we'll get into that a little bit later, why I eventually got my company, but we'll
right.
go from there.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about some of those operations, the initial in December 66 into January 67, what you all were doing there around Dong Ha.
Well, we left Dong Ha on the 19th of December.
Okay.
We were only there a week, and we were assigned AO area of operation in the Kobe Tonton Valley.
Okay.
This was supposed to be a 3 to 4 week operation.
Mm-hmm.
Where we'd move in there, set up a basic battalion base camp, patrol around the area, make contact with the bad guys, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So we got in there on the 19th of December, which was right before the Christmas, or the first Christmas truce. Hit a landmine going in, if I remember very distinctly that. The engineer vehicle got its right wheel blown off. No
mm-hmm.
one was hurt, thank goodness. The companies went in, took a few rounds of sniper fire. The biggest contact at that time came around the 21st when India Company was out on a post, and a bunch of the bad guys ran into them, and they killed about 45 of them.
Mm.
The battalion perimeter was, I use the term loosely, attacked twice during that period of time with a couple of the rifle companies firing their final protective fires into the assaulting masses of enemy. However, the next morning we'd go out and there would be no bodies.
Hmm.
So that basically, and another thing was the rain. It rained continually.
Really?
Yes, for 46 days.
Hmm.
And we were wet, we were miserable. And this is, of course, when I was still the S4 and also when eventually I did take over the company.
I'd imagine the rain made your job that much more difficult.
Exactly. Everything was getting bogged down. I mean, it was just a one big slush.
Hmm. Did you actually ever get into combat yourself during this time period?
During this time period, the only thing that happened when India Company made their contact
mm-hmm.
I took a small reaction force full with ammunition and everything else out, but as far as getting shot at, no.
Okay. Did you have a sense of the strategy being employed, that it was effective? Or did you see something at this point that was not working well and you wanted to change as far as how you all would operate in the valley?
At that point in time, no, because I didn't have hands-on. I wasn't aware. I wasn't with, if you will, the operational aspects of the battalion.
Mm-hmm.
I was still with the logistical aspects of the battalion.
Right.
So as far as the operational aspects, I would attend the briefings, of course,
mm-hmm.
listening. But my, if you will, my job at that time, or my profession at that time, were strictly in the logistical role, not troop leading.
Okay. How long were you in this position? How long were you all there at the Cobey-Tonantown Valley?
We landed there the 19th of December. We left there on, I picked up my company on the 3rd of January, mm-hmm. and we left the Kobe on, I'm looking here now, 8 March.
Okay.
So the 3 to 4 week operation turned into be a much longer time.
Yes, sir. And why did that happen?
Because of the initial attacks, they didn't know how many enemy were in the area. The India Company attacks, and later when I took over the company, we would make continual contacts.
Okay. Sir, why don't we take a break just for a moment?
Sure.
Okay, sir, why don't we continue? How did you get your company? What happened?
Well, a couple of things happened. First of all, the company commander, whose name I will not mention, he later got killed with another battalion, had, as I relayed before, 2 frontal assaults, so he said, on his position, where they fired the FPF, final protective line fires.
Yes, sir.
Everybody in the world would open up, fire the mortars, fire the artillery and everything else, and never had a body to show for it.
Mm-hmm.
He got amoebic dysentery. In that he was assigned a sweep one day, and he went to the battalion commander and said, hey, you know, I can't do this because I have amoebic dysentery.
Right.
Well, at the same time, I had amoebic dysentery,
mm-hmm.
but I did not make that known, and so this was on the 3rd of January.
Mm-hmm.
So we went out on a search-and-destroy type operation, a new company commander. I had no idea who my platoon commanders were, or anything else. It was just like, hey, throw me in the gap.
Wow.
Which I did.
How did it go?
It went well. I mean, we didn't make any contact, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But we went on out on the sweep, came on back in. And at that point in time, it was decided that the battalion commander, who I'll get into later when if we get into that type of a subject, decided
mm-hmm.
that since the other company commander was too sick to continue, that I should take over the company.
Okay. Was this my company?
This was my company.
Okay. Correct. Okay. How long did it take you to get to know your officers and everybody who would be working with you?
Now, the first thing I did was call in my officers, obviously.
Right.
And tell them, you know, they knew me from being the S4, which is a totally different thing because really in a line company, you know there's an S4, but you don't know who that individual is, or you know his name, you know, but you don't know anything about him.
Mm-hmm.
So I called in my officers, and I had one lieutenant with former enlisted service, and I had one Naval Academy graduate. I had another OCS graduate, and my XO was another OCS guy.
How would you rate the junior officers with whom you served?
The ones that I picked up or the ones that I had, I would say that they were probably the finest Marines that I've ever served with.
Okay.
As lieutenants.
Okay. And you were captain at this point?
I was a captain, that's correct.
Okay. Before we move into specific operations and what you all did, tell me about, I'm going to ask again about your leadership. Tell me about stepping into this role, being thrown right into the fire, basically, and how did you react to this as a leader? Was it a natural progression for you, or was it, did it take a little bit more time to adjust?
I would say that within a heartbeat, my mindset had changed from logistical to troop.
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm finally here, this is finally what I wanted to do, and now how do I go about doing it?
Mm-hmm.
The company commander that I replaced was a very well-liked individual, and that he was a, called his lieutenants by their first name, and of course they were always sir to him, because a Marine captain, even though it's only one pay grade above a first lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
Marine captain, particularly in combat, is God.
Yes, sir.
And this aspect of it, you know, I could not be him. I had to be me.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a glad-hander. I am not a, you know, the pat on the back, except if you really do something well,
mm-hmm.
or something of that nature. I am what I like to say, once again, professional, firm, and fair.
Mm-hmm.
And this was what I brought with me, and that's who I was, and that's who I had to be.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as breaking in with the new, there were a couple of, one of my lieutenants specifically was not too happy that I had taken over the company, and this was the former enlisted guy.
Mm-hmm.
He later got hit on the mid-January, I guess it was, and it was medevac from country. But anyhow, it was just a sense that I had because I felt that I could read people.
Okay, so he didn't really say anything to you.
He didn't say anything. It was just sort of, you know, when I'd say this is what we're going to do or this is how we're going to do it. It wasn't the way that we used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my thing was, well, I don't care how we used to do it. There are two ways to do it, the right way or my way.
Mm-hmm.
Three ways, actually. The right way, my way, or the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do things my way.
Okay. How did that work out, the relationship?
Initially, it was a growing period, particularly the missions being assigned then. The missions being assigned then were search and destroy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember what I told you about the weather at the time,
mm-hmm.
continually raining, we'd go online across a big rice paddy. Of course, the rice paddy water was up to at least mid-shin level.
Mm-hmm.
We'd get a few sniper rounds from a village or something of that nature. And then we'd shoot back and go in there, and there'd be a bunch of people there, which was not a good idea to shoot back, but there was some sniper somewhere shooting at us.
Mm-hmm.
And we made we actually killed very few of the enemy probably during my first 2 weeks with the company. And the biggest one, the biggest change in tactics, one time... very early on, we continually get shot at when we cross this one little bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent out, making a routine, if you will, sending out a patrol over that bridge at the same time every day. And this particular day, and the patrol at that time was normally a squad or at most a platoon,
mm-hmm.
this time I took out the whole company, and the bad guys had made the mistake to try to ambush a squad or a platoon,
mm-hmm.
and we pretty well decimated them.
Mm-hmm.
We had 40 mic-mics with us, the Army weapons, and this is when that lieutenant got hit.
Mm-hmm.
And by continuing on then, I mean, we killed quite a few of the enemy that day, which is the first actual solid success that the company had ever seen as far as seeing dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that atmosphere type thing. But one thing I noticed that they would continually shoot first at us. We didn't have the opportunity to shoot first at them.
Okay.
At this point in time, I went to the S3, who was a one of the, in fact, he actually ran the battalion. The battalion commander at that time, whose name I will not mention, during these alleged attacks that we had taken in early December,
mm-hmm.
I would go into the CP to see what was happening. He'd be crouched in a hole with his helmet on, flak jacket on, talking on the radio with his hand on top of his helmet. I could never forget that, you know, how not to lead troops,
mm-hmm.
type thing. Of course, his background was motor transport, but everybody having their ticket punched, which is another sore topic of mine,
mm-hmm.
He got a command of a rifle battalion.
Okay.
And thank God that he was eventually transferred. In fact, he was transferred in mid-January.
Mm-hmm.
So I then went to the S3 in combination with the S2 and found out what areas primarily the enemy was working in. So what we would do, we would go out like the typical Marine unit. Everyone had a case of sea rations on their back,
mm-hmm.
Double BA of ammo. Water was not a problem because it was raining all the time, and plus there were numerous streams and rivers in the area, and we'd go out on a sweep. We'd set in on, like, we have a hill, which the Marines would always pick the high ground,
mm-hmm.
make like we were digging in, fire in our artillery fires so that the bad guys knew where we were and what we were doing, and this is, if you want to attack us, you know, here we are. Then after dark, depending upon the moon rise, we'd move.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get up and we'd go in the dark, probably at least 6 to 8 clicks, where we'd set up, initially we set up in a series of squad-size ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
And Marine Rifle Squad, and the other thing I did too was pull an extra machine gun out of H&S Company, so each one of my squads would have a machine gun,
mm-hmm.
and I pulled out extra radios from H&S Company, so each one of my squads then would have a radio. And we'd set in, I'd assign an area to my platoons, my platoon commanders recommend to them where the ambush spots along that area would be, and before daylight, we'd set in,
mm-hmm.
and we would not move. So instead of now the enemy initiating the contacts, we initiated them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were the most stupid people in the world in that they never expected us to be there, never expected to do that. They'd come singing and laughing, literally, down the trail until they walk into the ambush, and then we'd hit them.
And I take it this was a pretty successful tactic.
Oh, extremely successful.
Did they ever learn to get, wind of this? Did they ever adapt and
no.
not do that?
And the reason being is because a couple of reasons. They never adapted to it in that when we sprung an ambush on them, we'd kill them all. The ones that we didn't kill, we wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened time and time again. We'd either get them as prisoners, but no one ever escaped the ambush. And then we'd have another thing that we would not bury the bodies, of course. We'd just leave them there. But we'd police up all the brass in the area like, we had never been there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd move after that ambush had been sprung to another area. In fact, sometimes we moved out of our artillery fan. And the bad guys would never expect anybody
right.
to move out of an artillery fan.
Right.
So to compensate for that, though, I had a section of 81s with me, which were two guns.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of my troops, in addition to their case of sea rations, would either carry 181 round or 260 rounds, and that included the company commander and
okay.
also claymores.
Right.
We were very heavy in claymores. So the typical rifle company then, and I would take somewhere with attachments, I would probably at that point in time take anywhere from, 220 to about 230 in the field with me.
Hmm.
I mean, we were heavy and we were loaded for bear.
Mm-hmm. How often would you go out? How often would these missions take place?
If you will, we established somewhat of a routine in this, and about the only routine I would establish in that, we'd go out for a period of 6 days, which would last when our sea rations
okay.
would run out. And after 6 days, it was my... Initially, we went out for four. Then we went out for seven. But in my opinion, at that time, combat effectiveness would suffer after about the sixth day because of the constant strain and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I established a routine where we would go out for 6 days, come back into the area. We had sea rations to eat for 49 straight days
mm-hmm.
when we were there. We never had a mess hall set up, never... or anything like that, so that when we come back in, the normal quota was two beers or two sodas a day.
Mm-hmm.
My troops mostly drank soda, I guess because of the age group.
Mm-hmm.
Clean weapons, tried to get immersion foot squared away, which was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the solution from higher headquarters was for immersion foot is to keep your feet dry.
Right.
And that's... very difficult to do as you're sloshing through rice paddies
mm-hmm.
when you're sitting in the bottom of a hole with water in it, or you're laying in an ambush position getting rained upon all day.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do in this case was just try to get as much as possible, have the corpsman look over the feet, take care of the strains or the, any bruises, bumps, or anything else that we had along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then have rifle inspection. Discuss the next area we've gone out, and on the third day, then we go back out again.
What would you do with your wounded if you were out in that middle of the six-day span?
Oh, if we had our wounded, if, in fact, we did have wounded, and
mm-hmm.
the amazing thing was we had exactly one, it wasn't until mid-February that we got our first wounded, and that was a butt stroke to the back of the head. We had ambushed a NVA or VC platoon
mm-hmm.
Coming down. There were 19 of them. We got 16K, and three prisoners. But what happened was one of my weights we set up, we'd have the majority of the platoon set up along the trail,
mm-hmm.
around 200 to 300 meters on each on the enemy side, if you will, because we'd have another platoon down the road mutually supporting them, mm-hmm. maybe a click away or something like that, but where no obvious avenue of approach would be, so the platoon would only have one LP.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, when they sprang the ambush on the VC, they had a rear guard, or two guys were lagging back. So as one guy went running by the LP, which is about 200 meters out, they stood up and shot him. And the other guy came running by, and instead of shooting the LP, they gave him a butt stroke to the back of the head, which obviously is a wound,
mm-hmm.
even though he had his helmet on, and they killed him also.
Okay.
But the morale was just unbelievably high. Since we were not taking any casualties, we were doing what Marines were supposed to do, you know, close with and destroy the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
The enemy never even saw us.
Were these your tactics that you had kind of devised, or was this something that the battalion was doing in general?
No, this is what I recommended to the S3. I said,
okay.
Hey, this is the way we got to go about doing this.
Right.
Now, to answer your question about our medevacs,
yes,
we did one time during this period of time, my platoon, one of my platoons in ambush position, not in a good ambush position, but at a crossroads, ran into an NVA battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And as the NVA battalion was coming on through, you know, they were counting them off. You know, here's 70, here's 80, here go the machine guns, here go the mortars. And I said, open up. And by that time, I had the other mutually supporting platoon. I had eventually got up there. But we had two Ks and three wounded out of that action.
Mm-hmm.
And the medevac birds came in and took out our wounded, but they would refuse to take our dead.
Mm.
And this sort of upset me, to say the least,
mm-hmm.
because now I had to have eight of my Marines carrying out two bodies.
Right.
That changed, because when I got back to the battalion, I requested to see the battalion commander, made a complaint about the air wing. In fact, that's not the first one, but we'll get into that one later,
mm-hmm.
That they didn't come back to take out the dead, and I lost eight effective Marines. Make short story long, the commanding general got a hold of that and told the air wing that they will take out dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I probably rambled off of that subject, didn't I?
Well, no, that's fine. That's exactly what I wanted for you to talk about.
Yeah.
Tell me, and let me ask a couple of general questions. How were you in combat? When you first experienced it, was it different from what you had imagined?
You know, my anticipation of combat, you know, I thought, you know, that we'd be shooting at them, they'd be shooting at us, but that, you know, that did happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are different types of my definition of being shot at.
Mm-hmm.
You can be shot at with mortars, artillery, or their area fire weapons, and if you get a hit with them, it's bad luck.
Mm-hmm.
The other way to get shot at is a personal shooting with small arms fire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are different types of getting shot at with small arms fire. Somebody else can be getting shot at with small arms fire, which you see them getting hit over there. The other type, which is extremely personable, is when they're shooting at you and they know you're shooting at you because you've got little things going digging up around you. You can actually see the wink of the weapon. You can hear the rounds going by.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say getting shot at in combat, I my definition of that would be when somebody personally shot at me.
Okay.
And in that case, I don't know whether it was just my eyesight, my experience, or whatever, but I could normally pick up the flash of the weapon shooting at me or near me, and I would deliver fire. And I'm a very good rifle shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I never carried a .45.
Okay.
Simply because I wanted to look exactly like one of my troops. I always carried a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And Marine company commanders are not supposed to shoot. However, that's one of the other rules that I broke. In fact, I did shoot.
Mm-hmm. Did you shoot most all of the time, or was it just sporadically?
No, I would primarily shoot if someone was shooting directly at me or if I had a target that no one else was taking under fire.
Okay.
But no, I did not go up there and play like rifleman.
Right.
My main concern first was to get the supporting arms in on the enemy,
mm-hmm.
and what we would call million-dollar days, or what I'd call them. If one sniper shoot at me, I would call the world in on him. I would fire artillery. I would get fixed wing air.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would make his life miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't care. You know, one round at one of my troops is, that's one too many.
Right. Tell me about life in the field. First of all, you personally, tell me about your uniform. What was on it? What did you carry?
I carried the same thing that all my troops carried, mm-hmm. with the exception of machine gunners and mortar people, obviously. I had a flak jacket, helmet, the case of C-rations on the back.
Mm-hmm.
I would have my map, flashlight, matches for heating tabs, even though they were in the C-rations, but I normally kept one. You always have your spoon with you. The spoon that you ate your food with,
mm-hmm.
and that was not very hygienic. As far as camouflaging, wouldn't do much with that. But I was just the basic, looked like any other Marine there.
Mm-hmm. What kind of weapon? You said you do not carry a .45, but you carry...
No, I carry a rifle.
Okay.
We went from the M14 to the M16.
And you did you have problems with that initial M16 jamming?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
That was later. That's when we were at Quezon when we got the M16.
Okay. Did you have a favorite weapon?
Yeah, I'd like the M14 much better than the 16.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing we used to do was called, if in fact we had to go out, when we did go out there, acting like the typical Marine company, we'd recon by fire.
Okay.
By that I mean we'd get up there and get online, you know, and we're gone towards the hill. And we'd have a mad moment where everybody shot a couple rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing we do with the M14, you could do it with the CS grenades. We'd shoot off CS grenades out to our front after checking the wind, of course,
mm-hmm.
Tear gas,
right?
To see if any of the bad guys were out there waiting to ambush us or anything of this nature. So and during the daylight, we'd make as much noise as possible, so that they knew that we were in that area,
mm-hmm.
so they didn't have to worry about the other area when we move at night.
Right. Was there any weapon that you wished you had that you did not have?
As far as a weapon, no. As far as a device, yes. The night vision goggles would have been a godsend.
Okay.
We very rarely made contact at night, and the myth, perhaps, at least I consider it a myth, is that the night belonged to the enemy.
Yes, sir.
And I that was not my experience at all. Any contact, particularly when we were moving, we twice ran into bad guys, but that was all. And we never got hit at night when we were out in the field in this type of an environment, when they didn't know where we were,
mm-hmm.
simply because they didn't know where we were and they couldn't plan to hit us. Did they hit that area or did they recon that area when we weren't there? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that is one of the biggest myths I think I know of,
okay.
that the night belonged to the enemy.
Okay. What was the most feared weapon, do you think, that your men had, that the VC or the NVA had?
That they had, I would say, we go into different type of fears now. Psychologically fearing, arty and mortars.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because of my experience with that, you just be getting pounded and you couldn't shoot back.
Right.
In fact, one time my second tour, but we'll get into that later, I made a little statement there, but that was the, psychologically, that was the and booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
Booby traps are also a big psychological weapon that the enemy employed.
Mm-hmm.
We found initially when we were on our sweep operations, when I first took over the company,
mm-hmm.
we probably tripped 15 to 20 booby traps.
Wow. Can you describe them? What were they like?
Oh, well, one I saw that we didn't trip was a 500-pound bomb that blew up at Ontos and killed a squad of Marines on top.
Jeez.
Other ones were 82 mortar shells, hand grenades, plastic explosives, punji pits, you name it, artillery shells.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't go off, 155 and 105, just a broad spectrum of whatever the enemy could get or the VC in this area, which are totally different now than the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they could get. The one time had a recon team attached to me that hit a claymore.
Mm-hmm.
You name it as far as booby traps go, and I either saw it or saw it explode.
Did you ever work with canine units?
Once.
Really? What was that like?
The canine units, we had a recon team get attached to us, and this is one of those things, again, this is while we were down in Fubai, and our tactics changed somewhat in the Fubai area,
mm-hmm.
and that the VC were, if anything, perhaps a little bit smarter, but the day before we were to go out on one of these typical things we went out on, they assigned me a recon platoon with a K-9 unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the lieutenant came to me and said, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, what can you do? Because I'm not going to assign you any missions that, you know, you're beyond your capability.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me what he could do, and I said, okay, this is what we're going to do. Go do your thing. If you need support, give a call. And they tripped a claymore. They were on a trail, unfortunately. Killed the dog, and I think killed one of them and two wounded.
Well, let's talk about the enemy in general. What were your impressions of the Viet Cong and then your general impressions of the NVA?
The Viet Cong were not very professional.
Mm-hmm.
Viet Cong were not as well-trained. Indoctrination, yes. All of them obviously had to be the same level of indoctrination just by virtue of the war that they were fighting way back in the mountains and the primitive conditions that they lived in.
Mm-hmm.
The support of the NVA, the logistical support, was not really good. Their medics, we did find a couple of hospitals, and one hospital in particular, we're in the Fubai area, and nurses, they did have some female nurses, and I'm sure they had corpsmen with them, but we never got to see them because, as I said, when we spring one of these ambushes, we kill them all or wound them.
Right.
Or taken prisoner. So the VC were, in my opinion, not as professional simply because logistically they were not able to be supported. They didn't have radios with them. The NVA battalion moving through did, but the VC per se were second teamers.
Okay.
The NVA, conversely, were first teamers. It's almost like they read the same books we did as far as infantry assaults.
Mm-hmm.
One particular time in September, when the battalion got hit, we got hit with mortars, artillery, rockets, followed by a frontal assault. I mean, it's just right out of the textbook,
mm-hmm.
across open ground, rice paddies, and it's the first time that I've ever seen that up to that point.
Mm-hmm. What were their common tactics of the two groups?
Common tactics of the two groups, normally the VC, my experience, would be ambush-type thing,
mm-hmm.
Picking on a soft target. When I say a soft target, either a probe or an outpost somewhere that wasn't well-defended, and something of that nature. The NVA would have a much larger force involved. The VC, I think the biggest VC force we ever ran to was a platoon reinforced.
Mm-hmm.
While the NVA, we ran into regiments.
Right.
By closer, since we were up near the DMZ.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever run into any foreign troops, Chinese, Pathet Lao?
There were rumors, obviously, you know, when one of the big, there was a larger than normal Vietnamese guy killed. In fact, we had to take one time back. It carried him back to the battalion CP. But, it never, in my knowledge, I was never told that any. I've heard the rumors that they had Chinese advisors, et cetera, et cetera. I know they had the Russian advisors in the north,
mm-hmm.
but I never ran into anyone like that.
Okay. Tell me about when we would capture the enemy. How would you treat them? What would you do with them, et cetera?
Normally, generally, and almost always, they were wounded. So the first thing we would do is have the corpsman take care of them.
Okay.
And next thing I would do is give them a cigarette if they smoked because they were normally not very happy in the sense that they were wounded and also in the sense of now, what are we going to do with them?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd call my Vietnamese interpreter. I had an individual in the company who went through language school who could speak Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
So then we'd start interrogating them, and inevitably they would tell us everything we wanted to know, even their mother's maiden name.
Really?
Oh, yes. I mean, there was no code of conduct, anything of that nature.
Hmm.
In fact, that found that even with the NVA.
Really?
Yeah. When we'd capture the NVA, and they'd be... the bad thing about that, even though we would capture them, even though they would be in our AO, and my advisor or my language speaker would speak to them, we never heard, at least at my level, what information they gave to the higher-ups.
Hmm.
In other words, hey, you know, okay, where is your unit located? Well, we're located near Mountain Umpty Squat, Nui Bajo,
mm-hmm.
for instance. Okay, how big are they? You know, they say all that. How many people were with you? Oh, you got the ball. They're all here. You know, what was your rank, et cetera, et cetera. All the military information. But, you know, this was a short period of time because then we'd report that we had a prisoner, and this is when they'd fly out the medevac bird to take away the wounded NVA
mm-hmm.
and also the prisoner, who
mm-hmm.
was also wounded. But as far as feedback from that source at my level,
mm-hmm.
I never received any back.
And I imagine you think that was a major problem.
I think that was an extremely major problem. Since I was operating in that area, and even though they were just passing through, somebody in that area helped them. Maybe the Phoenix program got them, maybe somebody else did.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, I'm there on the ground, and I'm not that far away from the people who had helped them
mm-hmm.
or where they were, so why don't you just send me?
Right. Did you have enough supplies in the field? Were you ever short?
Enough. I don't think you ever had enough. The most... Well, when you were talking about before about what you would take to the field, you always had a pair of socks with you.
Right.
Most, particularly during the rainy season there, the most thrilling thing going was to go ahead and put on a dry set of socks. Oh, I mean, that was just like heaven. Of course, 10 minutes later, you're wet again.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, that was the best thing going, particularly with the emergent foot casualties we had.
Mm-hmm.
And we had quite a few of those. Supplies, we'd go out with 2 meals a day, and I felt that that was more than enough, even though, because we were not moving during that period of time, we'd be just sitting in an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
Water was no problem. As I said, we had the streams and everything else through there. Batteries, radios, no. We never had any want for any supplies, but I feel that in a combat, maybe in the rear area,
mm-hmm.
in the rear area where I would like to see showers for the troops, I would like to see we had a warming tent,
mm-hmm.
that's what you want to call it, because as, you know, you go in two squads at a time, the troops would get warm, come back out, right into the rain where they get cold again.
Right.
Creature comforts, yes, we had little, if any, creature comfort. Supplies to fight a war, no problem.
Let's move on in your tour, and I have some more general questions that you can answer specific to these areas, but also in general. But after you left, you said in March 67, you left the Kobe Tonton Valley.
Right.
Where did you all go?
We were then assigned down to, and I'm looking at my thing here, from 9 March until the 2nd of June, we were in Fubai.
Okay. And what did you do there in Fubai?
Fubai, we did basically the same thing. We relieved a battalion down there who
mm-hmm.
had not had a contact, an enemy contact down there in, the whole time they were there. And that seemed a little bit strange to me. Why would they do that? So we started doing the same thing we did up at the Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
Go out during the day, set up, and then move at night. And with the first week, I think we had 3.
Huh.
So we did basically the same thing. Type of things, only in different areas. I would go to the S2
mm-hmm.
and find out where enemy activity was, like a, you know, VC platoon reported kidnapping people from this ville, shots fired along the Highway 1 at this location, and so there was obvious activity of enemy in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd, in this case, though, instead of walking out because of the large AO area of operations, sometimes we truck out, get off the trucks, pull up the typical thing, sweep through, make a lot of noise, pretend we were setting in for the night, and then move. The same general tactics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And they worked well there as well?
They worked well, yes, but not as well as because there weren't, in my opinion, as many of the bad guys there
okay.
As there were up in the Kobe Tonton initially when we got in there. another thing about the COVID, the one thing I did hear later, that there was a VC platoon about two clicks to the north in a little village up there. That when we left there, the remaining two surrendered.
Really?
Yeah, so we had pretty well wiped out that platoon. And and once again, my company was about the only one that did things in this matter.
How would you rate the communication that you had first amongst your company and then from the company going up, particularly with yourself and your superiors?
Communication in that radio, communication in that ability to speak, what kind?
All of that.
Radio communication was always good. I had grown up when we had the walkie-talkie type radios in my earlier Marine Corps. The PRC-25 was one of the best things in the world as far as communications. I mean, I could talk almost to God with that thing. I had my, you know, in my when I had ALO, air liaison officers with me, you know, they could speak to the world also over their nets. And my artillery people could speak. So we had, and you know, I mean, just it was just phenomenal. In areas where they could not speak, they would put in radio relay sites. So communications, radio communications, were outstanding. Never had any problem with that at all. Personal communications, that depended upon, to me, the rapport that you had with the individual as far as higher up. Going downward, I had no problem, obviously. Going up, I didn't have a problem. And that the S3, this time, a guy by the name of Woodring, as a major, would later take over a Marine battalion in country. In fact, at one time, six of the nine battalions in country were commanded by majors instead of lieutenant colonels because of their expertise in combat. And this guy was just phenomenal. I mean, if there was ever a mentor, that you know, he was my mentor. The battalion commander, the initial one, was a downright coward. The second one was a really great individual. And the third one fit in, the third one that we got was a coward, so I would tend not to speak to them. I would find someone, and by that time, of course, I had been well established since I had had the rifle company for such a long time. Periodically, we'd get visits from the generals who came in. And I was, if I happened to be in from the field, they would call me in and say, you know, what have you been doing? How have you been doing this and this and that? And it was very easy talking to them. The regimental commanders, which were above battalion, I might have seen them. I knew who they were, but I never had an occasion to talk to them. But the only time that I would get a radio message every once in a while, for instance, one time in Quezon, we had discovered a unused or unoccupied bunker complex, and there were some uniforms in there, so I reported back to battalion, you know, that we have NVA uniforms here, and, you know, and we found rice, So about 5 minutes later, to work back, regiment wants to know, how do you know their NVA uniforms? So that was easy. I called back. I had my radio operator. Found that they have Hanoi laundry marks in them. I mean, it was just, you know, there were certain people that, you know, if I could get to the right person, I could get it done. If I, the S3 watch officers sometime as lieutenants, after the fact, you know, I would go back and we would have little counseling sessions. When I say something, this is what I mean, you know, so on and so forth. And you would report my words exactly, not putting your own vernacular in. But generally, communications, like I say, at the battalion level, at the company level, great.
Okay. We talked about communication and relationships within your own company a little bit. I'd like you to expand on that a little bit. Did you ever hear anything about fragging while you were there?
No.
Okay. That was not a non-issue.
That was a non-issue. I mean, in, that was a non-issue. Very rarely. Well, first of all, very rarely were we in the rear.
Right.
Fragging, it seemed to me, if I did hear about it, it happened later. Probably, boy, 68, 69 era when I wasn't there. but I never heard of any fragging in the time I was there.
Okay. Okay. Did you ever sense any tension between those of you who were out in the field most of the time with, or tension between those who were back in the rear most of the time?
Tension? No, not necessarily. The people, my impression, of course, this might be me talking too,
mm-hmm.
you know, that there was always a palace guard around the wherever the battalion was set up. And the palace guard, I would call them around the rifle companies. Now, there was perhaps not necessarily tension, but it was a spree.
Mm-hmm.
While we were always out in the field doing things, you know, they were sitting back there doing what, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, justifying their existence, protecting the battalion, CP, whatever. So there was a sort of a elitism, if you will, within the company, because they knew they were good, and but as far as tension, fights, anything of that nature, no. Nah.
Okay.
No. Nah.
Okay. Andy, how would you rate the intelligence that you received throughout your first tour?
The intelligence that I received was developed mostly, but I have to put a caveat on that.
Okay.
Okay. Mostly it was internal intelligence from the battalion S2. And that's where I would go for my intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously had the radio intercept people there, the super secret things, that I would get a report in the field sometimes that there was an NVA or a VC unit located at, and then we'd go into the coding and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
When I work out these codes, that's where I was. And my normal comment at that time, I said, well, thank you very much. You know, we're shaking hands with them now. Would you like to speak to them? Because what the radio intercept people were doing were picking up our radio signals as opposed to the NVA, and that I wasn't, or VC.
Mm-hmm.
The intelligence we gained, I was unhappy, like I said before, about when we'd capture a prisoner. That the intelligence did not come back down. The intelligence went up, and in my opinion, it flew away.
Mm-hmm.
In this one specific battle, in September, after action report on that battle said that regiment knew that there were a bunch of bad guys in the area, yet the only thing I was ever told was from the company commander I relieved that they hadn't had a contact in 2 weeks.
Hmm.
And how I'd have rated intelligence. From my operating level on the ground, did I have a need to know? Damn well right I had a need to know. I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Was I told? No. Was someone told? I don't know. If someone was told, I would assume it would be either the battalion commander or the two, and I don't think the battalion commander would ever knowingly let his troops walk into something that big, that large, and that lethal without some idea of what was there.
Mm-hmm. How much did that interfere with your operations, and how much do you think it affected overall operations for the military there?
I can only speak from my level at the company level and perhaps to the battalion level.
Right.
It is very discerning to find out after the fact that somebody knew that there were a bunch of guys there and yet nobody told you.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose a bunch of your Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you are always combat ready. Yes, you are always have all your fire plans in and you... everything else, but still, though, there is always discerning not to know that somebody knew that their bad guys were right there all around you,
mm-hmm.
and nobody ever told you.
Mm-hmm.
How did it affect? I would say the effect it would have would probably increased casualties on the Marine side.
Did you let your Marines know that you weren't being told certain things
no.
after the fact?
No, because I didn't find what I'm saying after the fact. In some specific cases, I was already gone from country, and books then came out about it.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm referring about after the fact.
Okay.
I'm not talking about immediately after a major contact, for instance, saying, hey, they knew about it.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking like maybe a week or 2 or 3 weeks later, you found out some information. Did you share it with your junior officers and your other Marines?
I never, particularly after this last thing. The last thing in. My last official duty, if you will, in the tour,
mm-hmm.
No, I wasn't there.
Okay. So you stayed March to June in and around Fubai in that area,
right.
Performing basic still search and destroy missions, your style.
In my style. Not search and destroy, because I hate that word.
Okay.
Because they would destroy you while you were searching for them.
Right. How would you term your type of tactics then? What would you call them?
Find and kill.
Okay. Okay. After Fubai, where did Mike Company and the battalion move to?
We moved then up to Quezon, which initially we were supposed to go up by road convoy.
Mm-hmm.
That was on, we left there on the, let's see, notes say 2nd of June.
Mm-hmm.
The convoy stopped, got stopped up by the rock pile on the 3rd of June because the NVA had blown the road, or blown a culvert in the road.
Mm-hmm.
So we could not be trucked in. So we stayed the night of the 3rd, the day and night of the 3rd, there, and on the 4th of June, then, they lifted the Mike Company up to Quezon.
Okay. And were you at Quezon the rest of that tour?
No, we were from Quezon from the 4th of June to the 6th of September.
Okay. Let's talk about Quezon, then. What were your first impressions of the base?
You got to be kidding me. That was my first impression.
Okay, can you
explain? We were
that?
Down in the low ground on either side of us. There were just peaks.
Uh-huh.
And you could almost feel the bad guys looking at you.
Yeah.
And also the Quezon by that time had the reputation of, you know, in the early Quezon battles in May, June.
Mm-hmm.
881, 861, 634, which is not mentioned too much, 1019, the radio tower, the radio relay spot. And that was it.
Mm-hmm. Were you stationed at the base, or did my company go to one of the hills?
Oh, no. We did the same thing, only we did it a little bit differently here.
Okay.
Instead of moving out and making a lot of noise, the enemy threat being that close to the DMZ, I felt that I could no longer put out platoon-sized ambushes, and that the size or the potential size of the enemy forces in that area were such that I could no longer do that, and so I'd have to go out heavier.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, we didn't do that. The new battalion commander, we went on our first battalion, second battalion size operation.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean we had four of the rifle companies out, went out to this area that supposedly had good intelligence, you know, a whole bunch of bad guys in the area. And we never had a shot fired in anger.
Hmm.
After that one, we went out. That was only the second battalion-sized operation that the battalion at that point in time had ever been on.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly it was company platoon size.
Mm-hmm.
From that, then, we were assigned a section of the perimeter, which became old rather quickly. So we moved out again, only this time when we moved out, I would go out and set up like the typical Marine company.
Mm-hmm.
Because of didn't want to take chance walking at night, walking in something bad.
Mm-hmm. How often did you take out these missions?
We would go with the same routine again. This,
yeah.
2 days in, 6 days out.
Uh-huh.
The strange part at Quezon, the whole time we were there, we made contact exactly during this period of time from, from 4 June to 6 September, we had 4 contacts.
Really?
Exactly.
That's
4
incredible.
Contacts. That is incredible.
And knowing now what we know about how many of the enemy were in the area.
Yes.
Why do you think that was so infrequent, the contact?
Quite frankly, I don't think at that period in time they had built up. Remember now we're talking September.
Mm-hmm.
The first contact we had, we ambushed a platoon of the bad guys. Second contact we had, and it's an abbreviated contact. We got a couple of sniper rounds, and I call
mm-hmm.
that a contact.
Mm-hmm.
The third contact we had with a couple more sniper rounds. Never ran into a booby trap there. And the fourth one was a rather large one that we ran into a platoon, probably reinforced with 51 cals.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, those were the only 4 contacts we had there. And we moved around that area. I mean, we moved just about everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things we did there, right before we left, there was a going to intelligence again, a recon team kept getting shot out of an area. Every time they land in this area, they just run into a world of bad guys who would shoot them out of the area. So I figured, hey, there must be some bad guys there. So what we did then, we walked. It was a total of about, had to be 10, probably at least 20 clicks. We'd move at night, stop during the day, move at night, stop during the day, until eventually we got into this position where the and then we made a fake helicopter insert. In other words, pulling the normal thing, we had artillery shoot into the zone. The air wing was not too happy about this, but they made a fake insertion where they landed on the ground. But instead of a recon team, and we did have a few Marines get off the bird, so the bad guys could see just a couple. My company was set up all around this area, hidden in the woods. Make short story long on that one. No sooner did they leave than I was ordered to go down to the road, because this was happened on the 5th of September. We were supposed to move over to Contien.
Okay. Describe Quezon Base to me.
Quezon Base was a sort of a slack period of time during when I was there. The red dirt. That's, I think, one thing that you can always think. When you think of Quezon, you think of red. When you think of Quezon, you think of the surrounding mountains around you. It was a gorgeous spot, a beautiful spot. Of course, we never got into the ville or never saw anything like that. But it was a social event, so to speak, in that there wasn't that much contact. And I wouldn't say that we got loose or anything like that, because we were continually, you know, always ready when we went out. And by this period of time, it was a training. You know, we just got in the M16s then, too. So we trained with those things, you know, to get the zero in. It was a sort of a rehab, a refit station. And that was Quezon Combat Base. I mean, it was, they had an officers club there. My God, a real officers club. And you could go down there and get two beers. The troops would get, you know, their two beers and showers. I mean, it was just like first team living when we were there.
Right. Later, say a year later.
Yeah, well, we're not going to go later.
Right.
I wasn't there later.
Right. What, thinking back, you know, about your time there and then versus the siege time, what do you think about the two comparisons between the two? Can you imagine Quezon in that situation?
I can imagine Quezon in that situation. I cannot imagine the tactics that were used. And I've read quite a bit. I read the fact there about the tactics. You know, nobody allowed out more than 200 meters from the perimeter. Yeah, I can understand what happened to Dian Delta out there, you know, and the ambush and that whole thing. But the tactics, in my opinion, were just totally off. They were not Marine tactics. Marines are not a defensive force.
Right, right. In a general question here, did you ever employ snipers with my company?
Yes.
Can you describe? Go ahead.
Okay, we had snipers with us in the Kobe. We had snipers with us in one time in Quezon. And where the snipers made their contact, of course, since we only had the four, we never had them there, or they were never employed. But in the Kobe area, right after we had ambushed a platoon of the bad guys, there were three people running across, including one woman who the snipers took them down. Range, I would say, probably about 700 meters, running through an open rice paddy. That was the only time we've ever had snipers that actually employed their trade with us.
Okay. After your 3 months at Quezon running these operations, where did you go? Where did the battalion move out? Okay. Was this a battalion move?
This there was two companies of the battalion that had already gone over there. Mike Company and India Company went over there. Lima Company was on a Rough Rider mission at the time. So three of the four companies moved over there, with one company already being there.
Okay.
And that's when they pulled me off of this that fake insert thing, which I was unhappy about, spending almost 3 days getting in position to do this thing, and then all of a sudden they pulled me out before I had a chance to shoot a shot.
What happened? Why did that happen?
Why? Because the battalion had received orders to go to Quezon later, but I found out, not earlier, that there was a threat coming down on the, at this time, Contien was taking quite a bit of artillery fire,
mm-hmm.
and there was a threat coming down where they were going to interdict the supply or the main supply route from Camlo up to Contien to cut off supplies there and then assault the base,
mm-hmm.
or so intelligence said.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What kind of operations did you run in and around Contien?
I would like to back up on the way up there. We ran into Major Woodring, who used to be our battalion S3,
mm-hmm.
and he came out to the road to meet us, and he had been in that area almost 2 months, and this is the, obviously the first time we were ever there, and how you doing, Major, and one of the words that I'll never forget that he said is, if you go anywhere up here, go with your whole battalion, never go with less, if you have to, don't go with less than a company, but if you... you really want to go with the whole battalion.
Okay.
And we got up and we made a transition of lines up near a place called the churchyard,
mm-hmm.
where a company, and I believe they were from, I want to say 2-4, but I'm not quite sure. It might be 2-9. A company from 2-9. I talked to the company commander. They hadn't seen anything in 2 weeks. Hadn't made a contact in a month. The area's, quiet, nothing's happening the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point in time, 3rd Battalion, 26th Marines was assigned an AO area of operation, I would say roughly 5 clicks square, which is not a big area for a battalion.
No.
Initially, what I was told, that the reason why we were there was to go ahead, and also all the company commanders, we were going to go ahead and relieve the battalion that was currently defending Contien.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to move in there and prepare positions to defend Contien.
Mm-hmm.
In the interim, though, just go on out and, this is your AO. Well, second day there, India Company, which was the 7th of September, India Company and Mike Company were assigned patrol routes with company minus. In other words, only 2 platoons would go out. I was very, very hesitant to do that.
Mm-hmm.
When I went out with my mortars. I had pre-planned artillery all the way along the way, and I just shot up everything I could everywhere,
mm-hmm.
moving on out. India Company moved on out and fell in a world of trouble.
Mm.
The company commander got hit, I think, somewhere around, I don't know, I have the exact numbers somewhere because
mm-hmm.
there's a book out about it.
Mm-hmm.
But they just got really bad news hit. And we came back in from our patrol at the same time. India Company had reported that they were in heavy contact. So I recommended to the S3, because at this point in time, battalion commander, the old 2nd battalion commander had been rotated. And we got a new battalion commander who I won't go into. So I talked to the 3. Who used to be one of the company commanders and got frocked up as a senior captain and said, hey, we're ready to go. And instead he sent out another company who also stepped in a world of harm. Make short story long, we received an assault that day. I lost one of my better platoon commanders. It was KIA'd. I think it was 8 or 9 wounded and 3 Ks. But we repulsed the assault. And we also picked up a prisoner.
Okay.
But this was strictly conventional warfare.
Mm-hmm.
From the 7th of September, the battalion moved out on the 8th to go to another location, but Mike Company stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why Mike Company stayed there is when the helicopter came in to lift out. Our wounded are already gone, but when they came in to lift out the POW, when the bird was taking off, the rotors hit a tree and fell back down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Company was given the dubious distinction of securing the landing zone till a bird could come in to take out that helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
I was not too happy about this.
Right.
Because while the rest of the battalion is going away, I'm sitting out there like a sore thumb.
Mm-hmm.
We had, contrary to orders and contrary to proven procedure, set up a couple of booby traps outside of our old position that started going off. And I called in the world on that old position, including every single round of my 60 mortar HE, and got to the point where I was firing illumination rounds, trying to, in my opinion, because there was a bunch of the bad guys coming.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, the bird got picked out in late afternoon, and we rejoined the battalion on this spot, where we immediately started getting artillery fire. Now, there's a sense that you have when you're in combat that you know what direction fires are coming from, particularly artillery and mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my contention at this time that they were coming from Camp Carroll. And no one else would believe this. I reported to the battalion and said, hey, you know, that is, we are getting friendly artillery fire.
Mm-hmm.
The bad guys aren't there. I know where the bad guys are. The bad guys were over there because they had shot us before. But no, no, Camp Carroll, make short story long, it was Camp Carroll shooting at us. Lima Company had 1K and 3 wounded. No people in my company, thank God, got hit. And, but that fire eventually stopped.
Mm-hmm. How common was that friendly fire?
Very, very uncommon.
Okay.
Now, that was the first time that we had ever got hit. Well, first time with artillery or mortars. Excuse me. One time with twice with air,
while
we had a caisson. One time, Dash 2 dropped a 500-pound bomb. And the second guy, after they had already come over, Dash 1, the first line in the flight, Dash 2, the second guy, had already bombed this target that we wanted. Both had been in there once. The second time around, first guy put his bomb on target. Second guy dropped early, and one of our platoon commanders got wounded.
Okay.
Which, once again, made me a little bit unhappy and irate.
Mm-hmm. How could you complain up the line? Were you able to?
Oh, yes. My first complaint went to the... We were in radio contact with the birds, and that I had my ALO with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the line, and I said something to the effect of, I would like now to give your bomb damage assessment to Dash 2. You have just dropped a bomb in my positions, and if I ever see you, I will do harm to your body. Or not quite those words, but you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I did, I called up battalion and complained to them about getting that. And my understanding is this was not, my understanding is that it went up the chain of command, came back down, and the guy got a letter of reprimand. The other time this happened with air, it wasn't necessarily a short round, but they dropped me in the wrong zone. They had a... the gunships down in the Kobe area had worked over an NVA or a VC company, and so I happened to be back in getting ready to go out the next day, so they put me out that day instead of the next day, dropped me in three different landing zones instead of the one, so I was never able to get my company together until after dark to go figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, the general came in. I personally briefed the general, and the Air Wing story was that they were receiving... it was a hot zone.
Mm-hmm.
My story was that there was not a shot fired in anger.
Mm-hmm. Why the discrepancy?
I think that my opinion of Marine aviators, particularly of a senior rank, is that they were worried about getting home.
Mm-hmm.
I had experience with both Marine and Army birds. Some of the Marine helicopter pilots were outstanding individuals. Other ones were... I don't choose to go there. The support that I received from the U.S. Army, primarily in the second tour, was just unbelievable. I mean, they'd land in a hot zone. They'd pick up, they'd go right through a whole wall of fire to come in after me. But we'll get into that maybe second tour.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Were you ever wounded on this first tour?
Yeah.
What happened?
I got hit with shrapnel in the leg, and I got hit with shrapnel in the... Achilles tendon, and I thought that happened on the 10th of September. Well, the first time was 7th September.
Mm-hmm.
Second time was 7th September, and I was afraid to look at my foot. Yeah, so I turned to my radio operator. We're laying down at the time. I said, "Is my foot still there?" Because I'll tell you, it hurt.
Right. Did it sever your Achilles?
No, it did not sever. It was just one little point that went in there, one little plunker I still have.
Really?
One little piece of shrapnel.
Uh-huh.
Of course, my helmet and my pack and my air mattress particularly got holed, and I was sort of unhappy about that because I always like to have an air mattress with me.
Right.
Oh, which is another thing I carried with me
okay.
in the field. Always an air mattress.
Okay. Now, you were getting short. Were you aware of the date you'd be leaving, or was this something that was kind of left up to the Corps to tell you?
I knew that I would be there 13 months.
Right.
And I had gotten in country on the 26th of August, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that I'd be out of there by the 26th of September, which was my 13-month tour.
Right.
Or thereabouts. And, yeah, I was getting short. In fact, that was the original company that I picked up. We had still 12 Marines left of the original company that came over from Vietnam.
Huh. Okay.
Which is another bone of contention.
Yes,
another,
I can imagine.
The bone of contention here was when we were down in Fubai, they took roughly one-third of my company and spread-loaded them out to other units. In other words, I would get Marines from 1-9, 326 Marines would go to 2-4, 1-9, or whatever, so not everyone would have the same rotation tour date.
Hmm.
Well, normal attrition took care of that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I lost during Fubai was, once again, I had to retrain my whole company.
Right.
Because that's another subject, another sore subject.
Unit cohesiveness, I guess, goes out the window to a point.
There you go, in piecemeal replacement. And by the time, you know, who is this guy, you know, and what does he do? And by the time you know him, it takes a while till you trust him.
Right.
It's the first time you both get shot at together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's neither here nor there. We're still back in September. Did I know? No. I did not know an actual day.
Okay. Did you change your habits any at all, knowing that you were be going home probably in a month or around that date?
You know, quite frankly, when this thing in September happened, I didn't think I was going to go home at all.
Really? You thought you were going to be killed?
Oh, yeah.
It was that bad there?
Oh, yeah.
How long did the contact last? Was it constant, or
it started at on the 10th of September. It started with a frontal assault against India Company across an open rice paddy by at least a battalion of the NVA, and they didn't see me or my company. And mm-hmm. my company just started mowing them down. And
were you on their flank?
Yes, we were providing flank security. This is going to be another walk in the sun.
Okay.
India Company. Who had just been replaced, the company commander of India Company had just been replaced. He had been wounded on the 7th.
Mm-hmm.
So the new company commander came in, a guy by the name of Matt Caulfield, who later retired as Major General.
Mm-hmm.
They decided they were going to give him a little bit of experience operating with his company,
mm-hmm.
And this would be a great day to do it because we were only going to move 3,000 meters, but he'd get his finger or his feet so to wet,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to be a walk in the sun because there are no bad guys there. Well, he started on out, and by the time his first platoon got there, they were taking 51 cal fire and heavy volume of mortars and also AK-47s.
Mm-hmm.
They reported back that he had a platoon in front of him. Well, that 51 cal's mortars and that a volume of AKs are not a platoon.
Right.
So basically what happened is they launched the attack on his flank, but Mike Company was out there on the flank anyhow, saw him coming across rice paddies, so we started mowing him down.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad guys then decided it was a good time, instead of going against India Company, go against the guys that were hurting them, so then I got a frontal assault.
Mm.
And my second platoon commander was killed. My third platoon commander, who had already dead, I pulled in my XO, he got wounded.
Mm-hmm.
All my platoon sergeants were dead. My first platoon commander reported that he was killed. Later, that came to be not true.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, it was reported all my platoon commanders, all my platoon sergeants were dead. And I came out, I think, with 114 people.
Wow. Andy, can you describe, for people who will be listening to this and reading this in the future, what an NVA frontal assault looks like and feels like?
Boy. When you first see it, you can't believe it. I mean, there is nothing there, and the next second, you move. In fact, I think the best description I heard of this is one of my troops saying something like, oh, shit, the whole mountain just moved.
Hmm.
This was on the other side now of the rice paddy.
Mm-hmm.
And this was right, and it literally looked like the whole side of that hillside, and it was low scrub brush, I'd say, oh, not higher than 4 to 5 feet, if that high. Probably more like waist high.
Mm-hmm.
But never saw them there. And, of course, they didn't see me there because I had been there quite a while. But they did see the movement from India Company as India Company was moving up.
Mm-hmm.
After the initial shock, so to speak, then that's when started moving people around to get them in a good firing position, particularly my my machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And M79s. And my mortars were back in position. I had my artillery guy started calling in fire. I mean, it was just a mass confusion type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as long as they were going at India Company, it was like a shooting gallery. They were not, it wasn't people who were out there, they were targets.
Okay.
They had no personality, they were just targets. When they turned and started coming towards me then, and my platoons, that's when it really became personal. The second platoon was in front of me, which is the headquarters group.
Mm-hmm.
The third platoon was to my left, and the first platoon was to my right. So we were more or less in a company echelon right formation.
Mm-hmm.
When they came into us, it was just mass chaos, confusion. I've heard the term also, and it's not an original one, the fog of war.
Right.
Just did not... And during this period of time, too, we were taking heavy incoming from mortars and shifted fires from India Company over to Mike. We got hit with rockets. We had a tank with us that had broken down.
Mm.
So if there was ever an aiming stake, it was the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And the tank, broken down, did not fire around in anger while the bad guys were coming up. But
did it get hand-to-hand?
Not that I saw hand-to-hand.
Okay.
It's, I think, you know, I never knew what fear was before until this time.
Mm.
And it was the first time in my entire combat tour that I knew actually what fear was. And fear to me was, it was almost like I was frozen. When I got hit, for instance, how in the hell did that happen? Words going through my mind, you know. And then, please God, get me out of this thing. And then I started receiving these hysterical radio voices over the radio. And so then, I don't know, there was just almost something like a cloud that came over, that it wasn't me, but it was somebody else.
Right.
And I think it was probably a training.
Right.
Anyhow, on that one, then, I regained my sense of humor. I knew what fear was. Mm-hmm. God knows I knew what fear was.
Right.
And I started functioning again in the manner to which I thought was appropriate.
How did you deal with the fear? I guess, did you kind of sweep it away, let it take its hold on you, let it go away, and then did you reflect on it later, or did it stay with you, and you functioned in spite of it?
I think... after the initial fear came in, I was too busy doing other things to reflect on, you know, well, I knew I was going to die.
Mm-hmm. Were you conscious of that thought?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you surprised later that you had not been killed?
Very much so, because from that point on, I did a number of stupid things.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, like exposing myself to the bad guys, you know. When some of my Marines were pinned down, I went out and got them. Shot a bunch of bad people. You know, just things like that.
Right.
It was almost like a reaction type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I never really thought about it until that point, you know, much later, which I'll go into.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just almost like a calm came over me.
And this isn't all in your last 45 days.
Well, this is in my last, actually my last 20 days.
Wow. What a way to go out.
Yeah. I think you hear how he came in the second door.
Okay. Tell me your opinion, or is there anything else that you want to say about that day and that assault and what you went through?
Except my Marines are outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. I mean, they did everything expected of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, eventually we got out of there then. We got out of there the 11th of September. They pulled us back down to, ironically enough, Camp Evans, Kobe Tonton.
Mm-hmm.
And on the 15th of September, the battalion commander called me in and said, "You're going in R&R." I said, "Why? I've already been in R&R." He said, "You will pay orders, Captain," and I left. So I was really gone then.
That was it?
Yeah.
That was it.
Well, I came back to the battalion for a... by that time, they already had another company commander there, so I called my troops together. That's quite a while.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Called my Marines together. About 110 left.
Mm-hmm. What was your original strength?
A little bit over 200, 202 when I went in.
Okay.
And I just left.
You were able to speak with them before you left?
Oh, yeah.
Them.
Yeah.
What did you tell them?
It was a pleasure being with them. Hope I'd serve with them again sometime.
Mm-hmm.
They were a brave bunch of men that I'd ever seen.
Were you able to make contact with any of them later?
Oh, much later, yeah.
Right, much later.
In fact, we still have our reunions now.
Yes, sir.
My radio operator, he got hit that day, too. But he is, we're all close, I would say. I only had one platoon commander, about two platoon commanders left living.
Right.
And one was hit, the other one wasn't.
How did you deal with death on the battlefield and in combat? I don't think the average person can fathom what that would be like. How you function in the face of that, and then after action, how you deal with, you're talking about a very serious subject here. You're talking about this action. You're talking about your platoon commanders being killed. How did you deal with that?
My personal way of dealing with it was a detachment.
Mm-hmm.
When one of my Marines would get killed, it was hopefully, we'd call in the medevac right away, obviously. We'd have the corpsman working over them. Some of them were just couldn't save.
Right.
It's quite a few of them I saw before they got medevaced. And some of them, they just like, for instance, one or two specific examples. Had a platoon sergeant got hit with one little piece of shrapnel, walked to the helicopter, got on, and he died. And my gunnery sergeant in caisson get hit with one round through the leg,
mm-hmm.
and he died.
Femoral artery?
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. That's exactly what happened to him.
Yeah.
And, why them? I had my radio operator right behind me get hit through the arm. In fact, he was on the ground behind me, and I'm standing up shooting, and mm-hmm. he gets hit. I mean, how do you deal with it, boy? I'd say initially it's you're doing other things, and so you're too busy to really concentrate on it then. When does it hit? It still does.
Mm-hmm.
But it's after the fact, though, much after the fact.
Right.
Because one thing you could not do in that situation, just break up. Right. Everybody's looking at you. I mean, you're the guy in charge.
Right.
So if you start, you know, really gnashing your teeth and weeping, I mean, it's all over. The company just ceases to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with me, I mean, I had the company longer than any other company commander there.
Mm-hmm.
And of the original company commanders that went over there, three of them got killed, and the other guy was seriously wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And very rarely would they last more than 3 months. And I was sort of, you know, probably in my own mind, too, a legend, you know, that I'm still there.
Right.
And that was the other thing, too, is about 6 months in combat and get transferred to another, you know, only 6 months in command. I mean, I would have probably requested mass with the general. They would have tried to transfer me from my company.
Right.
It didn't happen.
Right. What did you think of the 13-month rotation policy? Do you think that the United States military should have implemented a policy and a rotation policy that we had in other wars, that you served until the war finished? Or did you think that this worked well, what we did in Vietnam?
It didn't work well in the sense that there was no... Once again, if you went over there with a unit like the early people did, they went over there in the 65, 66, and somewhat with the 27th Marines when they went over there as a unit, it was much better. My experience, or from what I've seen, for instance, on the 13-month tour, what I would try to do once one of my troops had in 12 months, if he didn't have his three Purple Hearts by that time, if he had in his 12 months, I'd try to put him in the rear and go work for the first sergeant.
Right.
Go do something like that. My lieutenant that I had, my XO, I had him in the rear just tidying up because he came over. He was one of the original lieutenants that came over. My other platoon commanders, if they were the last 6 months and none of them did, I would transfer them out of the company or have them, even no matter how good they were, because, you know, they were just... It was too much. It
right.
was more than you know, that I could ask them to do in that period of time. But the rotation policy was a political decision, I believe.
Yes, sir.
Unbased, unfounded, it went against all tenets of the Marine Corps. Because you get the new guy in, you don't know who the new guy is. You have to train him. You know, well, how does he fit in? Oh, boy. I mean, it caused more problems than it solved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as remaining there the whole time, we would probably had less of a protest in that the people, the draft, would not have needed as many people. So that was obviously a political decision. The Army had 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Marine Corps had 13, the Army had 12, so that means, you know, there were, if you look at the logistical tail in Vietnam, which is the other thing, they had a relatively few number of people actually out in the bushes shooting at people. The Army's logistical tail, it seems to me, was somewhere around 9 or 10 to 1, while the Marine Corps tail was something like 7 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
So for every rifle guy you got out there shooting, there were 7 guys back there supporting them. And these 7 guys back there supporting them are getting the same combat pay, getting the same tax breaks, if you will, as the guy who's out there getting shot at every day.
Right.
So yeah, is it fair? No. Is there a better way to do it? Yeah. The whole concept of building up a United States in Vietnam where, you know, the air-conditioned bunkers and the sheets on the bed and the whole thing like that, that isn't how you fight war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that answers your question.
It absolutely does. Absolutely. Let's talk about leaving Vietnam. But before we detail that, you said you did take an R&R?
Yeah, well, I went over to Okinawa.
Okay.
And got off the plane. And first thing I did, went over to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
I started at the top. And I could see how many rows having one drink of everything, anything along the way.
Right.
And I got through, I think, 2 rows.
Did you really?
Yeah, that was pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, clearly, I wasn't drunk, or at least I told myself I wasn't drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Walked in, went to sleep, woke up the next morning, and I started writing a little paper on what I had learned in Vietnam, because I figured, you know, once I get back there, I am due to rotate. In fact, my order should have been in by this time.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote up the little paper, and all required to do that. I had it typed over there.
Mm-hmm.
And went back to Vietnam, got a Rough Rider convoy up to the battalion, walked in and said, oh, here are your orders. Got back on the Rough Rider convoy and went back down and left country.
Wow.
Yeah, that was my ending.
Wow. Where did you fly out of?
Flew out of Phu Bai.
Okay.
No, not Phu Bai. It was down Dong Ha.
Okay. And how long before you're back?
Not Dong Ha, Da Nang, excuse me.
Okay. So out of Da Nang, and how long did it take you to get back to the States?
Well, it took me actually 2 years because we left on my birthday. And so we crossed the international date line. It was my birthday again.
Okay.
No, it was probably about a 20-hour flight back. Once again, it was my birthday.
Uh-huh.
Of course, no alcoholic beverages would be allowed on the plane. But once the stewardess found out that my birthday somehow or another, magically a couple of bottles of champagne happened to show up.
That's a nice birthday present, getting to leave Vietnam.
That's a true story.
Hmm. How much contact had you had with your family and your wife when you were in country?
I went in one R&R.
Okay.
And when she asked me what I was doing, I was, you know, just in the rear with the gear. And I, you know, my mother, I used to write her at least once a week. And I, you know, I was on convoy duty going back and forth between just carrying stuff out, you know, to not doing anything harmful.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate thing, this 10 September battle made the papers everywhere. And Mom found out about it then, but that was sort of after the fact because I was almost coming home by
right.
that time.
Your name was in the paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And
so you protected them. You shielded them from what was really happening.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, had to. And wife found out about it. And, normal Marine Corps policy is when you put down, if you get hit, you want your family notified. And I said, no. Well, wife got a telegram. Normally the Marine Corps policy was, you know, that they would personally come up to the house, knock on the door and say, hey, your husband's been hit, nothing bad, return to duty, but she got a telegram. Of course, that was a little bit ballistic time there, too.
Right.
But almost after the fact again, and that I was, you know, already in Okinawa by that time, and I had called her.
Okay, so you get home. Where did you fly into the United States?
Flew into airport near San Francisco.
Okay.
What am I thinking of?
Right.
I don't know. All I remember is that I took a bus to go get a real airplane from that. Travis? Would it be Travis?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay. That'd probably be it. Flew into Travis, went through customs inspection, got on a bus, went down to the airport, still in uniform, and flew in to San Diego.
Okay. And that's where you were able to reunite with your family?
That's correct.
Okay. What was that like, being back in the United States so quickly and seeing your family again?
Shock. I mean, particularly when it happened. I mean, if it was, you know, if I was sitting somewhere, you know, and had time to go ahead and plan this, you know, or coming back and the whole thing like that, and, you know, if nothing had happened during that period of time, it would have probably been an easier transition.
Right.
But just going from where I was, even though with the R&R thrown in there, it gave me some time to settle down to get back. It was a different world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also a coping type of a thing, too. You know, here I am. What am I doing here? And thank God I'm back.
Right. How did you adjust, or how long did it take you?
I don't feel, there probably was, but I don't feel that there was an adjustment period per se.
Okay.
Then when I came back, I also knew that my next tour of duty was going to be from there, I was going to go to Amphibious Warfare School at Quantico, mm-hmm. which is the mid-level school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was due to start whatever, but in the interim, I was to report to OCS, and I had my 30 days leave and
mm-hmm.
you know, travel time and the whole thing. So it was sort of like fell back into being dad Marine instead of Marine killer.
Right. And you were able to do that effectively?
Oh, yeah. I felt that that was... I had no problems in those aspects. I mean, no personal problems, nothing of that nature.
Okay.
No.
How much discussion was there of your experiences in Vietnam? Did people ask you about it? Did you talk about it much?
No.
Why not?
No on both. Well, yeah, some people... I wasn't, you know... No, you know, it was... there weren't any in-depth type things. If people wanted to know about Vietnam, it wasn't really... wanting to know, there was just a conversational type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I call you, just got back, yeah. How was it? It was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in depth, not even with wife or children or anything. No. No in depth discussions.
Well, do you think looking back that was good or bad, or it didn't matter?
In my particular case, since I did it, I don't see any adverse effects that I had from it.
Okay.
I don't know if I would have dwelled on it, I would have probably not been the same person, but in retrospect, I could say probably it was good for me.
Okay. Andy, why don't we take a break?